This is the Environment Show. It's about our stewardship of the Earth and the beauty and mystery of life in all its forms. I'm Peter Burley. Coming up, Minnesota Governor Jesse Ventura, elected on the Reform Party line, talks about where his party stands on the environment. Tax and spending bills being fought over in Congress may give big breaks to companies that lumber, mine, and drill for oil on public lands. In our continuing series on the search for the origins of life, we meet the researcher who has discovered the oldest fossils known to science. He says they prove Darwin's theory of evolution is flawed. And on the Earth calendar, it's a struggle, but crayfish in Missouri are surviving. These stories and more coming up on The Environment Show. You're listening to The Environment Show, and I'm Peter Burley. Ross Perot's Reform Party collected enough votes in the last presidential election so that its candidate for president will qualify for federal campaign financing next year. We have not heard whether the party has a position on the environment, so I asked Governor Jesse Ventura of Minnesota. He says he's not a presidential candidate, but gives us an insight on how his party will approach environmental issues. I'm speaking with Governor Jesse Ventura of Minnesota. And Governor, when you ran for office, you ran as an independent candidate of the Reform Party, the party that had been formed by Ross Perot. And in so doing, you beat both a Democrat and a Republican, and also are now the highest elected official in the Reform Party. When it comes to the environment, where does the Reform Party stand?
You know, I'm going to explain the way the Reform Party works. I may be the highest level of elected official in the Reform Party, but it by no means makes me the expert of the Reform Party. And the one thing that I firmly believe in and why I'm with the Reform Party, if I could explain it for a moment, is that we are a party that really allows you to be you. We don't make people necessarily channel themselves or have to become a certain type of individual to be part of our party. You can be yourself and be a member of the Reform Party, and I think that's what attracts me very much to the party. We do stand very, very strongly on certain issues like campaign finance. We don't believe in taking PAC money or any special interest money, and we think that that's inherently what's wrong with our political system today, is that all our elected officials are in essence bought and sold by special interest money. And so by not taking special interest money and not allowing it in the Reform Party, it allows us to be ourselves and to stand for what we believe in. So the opinions I'm going to give you today aren't necessarily some written in stone part of the Reform Party. They're more of just Governor Jesse Ventura's opinion on where he stands on environmental issues, which the Reform Party allows me that freedom because of the fact that I don't owe anybody anything, be it big business, be it even environmentalists, because we do not accept that type of special interest money, which then gives us great freedom to base our decisions on what we personally believe in, and that's what attracts me to the Reform Party.
So if the party grows and you have a substantial numbers of people holding office in various places, it's unlikely then, as I take it from what you say, that there would be a consistent view. One might have a strong anti-regulatory person in one place and somebody else who was looking for more command and control, that this is not the kind of issue that would cause
naturally we will address issues as they happen, and I think that, you know, environmental issues are I believe that we do need a standard set at the federal level. And I think most Reform Party people would agree with me, because when it comes to pollution and environmental issues, they cross state lines. I mean, states are only lines on maps that are created by man. And you have rivers that flow from one state to another. You have air quality that, of course, will go from one state to another. So I think we in the Reform Party would all be in agreement that we do need a federal agency to handle these type of tasks because they are universal to our country. And so I don't think you'd get a lot of opposition within the party that we do need an environmental protection agency at the federal level, which gives us a consistent policy across the land, which would affect environmental issues.
I guess another big sort of watershed issue relates to the vast amount of public lands in the United States. And there are those on the more conservative side of the fence who feel that there should be less federal presence and that these should be privatized and so on, and others who take the opposite view. On this spectrum, do you see the Reform Party having weight in one direction or another?
Well, I don't think they've really weighed in on it, to my knowledge. And again, I don't want to sit here and try to claim I'm the expert of the National Reform Party agenda, because I'm not. My job right now is to govern the state of Minnesota, and believe me, that's a full-time job. And it's not my job to form national policy in the Reform Party, nor is it my job even to form state policy, because we have leadership in both of those positions, and that's their job to do that. But I think, me personally, I think that, again, you have to find a happy median. You have to find something that's common sense. Certainly, we don't want to privatize everything. If I can give an example, I think one of the great things about the state of Hawaii is the fact that every beach must have a public access. You cannot own a beach in Hawaii, no matter how wealthy you are. That beach still must allow anyone from the public access to it to enjoy it. And I think in a lot of ways, that's a good idea to have across the country in many of our lands. Certainly, we want to respect private property. Certainly, there are private property rights. But I see nothing wrong in a certain amount of public domain that ensures the integrity of that land. Like here in Minnesota, we have the Boundary Waters Canoe Area. And I would never, ever want to see that area touched, because that is a natural wilderness area that I believe needs to be left intact for not only the wildlife, but for us humans, so that we can always see and be able to visit and participate in a real natural habitat up there that money cannot buy. And so I think that's money very well spent.
Governor, I want to thank you for being with us. My guest has been the Honorable Jesse Ventura, Governor of the state of Minnesota. Most of the economic news coming out of Washington in recent weeks has related to proposals to cut taxes. Simultaneously, the Congress has been debating expenditure bills which appropriate the money to run the government. Every year, it seems that environmentalists and commodity interests fight over these appropriation bills. The enviros claim that our national treasure is being given away, while the private companies who take timber, oil, and minerals off public lands want better terms and fewer environmental restrictions. Our Washington correspondent, Nancy Marshall, joins us to discuss some of the issues. Nancy, this is the season when a lot of work is being done on the budget. What are some of the issues respecting the environment that have come up in the budget debate?
Well, probably the biggest issue concerns mining companies. Under the 1872 Mining Act, companies had 5 acres of land they could set aside to use as a dump, basically, for every 20 acres of claim of land that they were mining. Now, the mining companies say that was okay back in 1872, but now with modern mining techniques, they're getting at gold that's deeper in the mountains, and they have to use things like cyanide to leach away piles of rocks so they can get to that buried gold, and they have to do something with the piles of rock that are left over. So they say they need more than 5 acres to dispose of this material.
And just to make this clear, these are 5 acres on public land, so that in effect they're saying we want more public land in order to be able to extract more of the public's resources, which we then use for our own gain. Isn't that really the fight about the whole Mining Act?
That's really the fight, and it's an ongoing debate. You know, people say this is public property that they're using, they have to take care of it, and they say, well, we're paying for use of this property, and we should be able, the government should be a bit more flexible.
Nancy, oil is always an issue. What's happening in the oil patch as it relates to Washington this year?
Well, there are the usual arguments over how much the oil companies should be paying to use public lands, how much they should be paying in royalties. Environmental groups say that oil companies are underpaying by $66 to $100 million. So there is one provision that's being batted about that would increase the amount of money that oil companies pay in royalties.
It's hard to talk about budget without thinking about taxes. What's going on in the environmental side with respect to the tax proposals that they've been looking at?
This is very interesting. Environmental groups say the timber industry alone would get $82 million in tax breaks from the tax bill. And extractive industries, that would be oil, gas, timber, they would get $30 billion worth of tax breaks.
Nancy, one of the things the administration has been interested in is their land legacy program. What's happening there?
Yes, this is Vice President Al Gore's baby. He wants more of the money that's in the Land Water Conservation Fund to actually be appropriated by Congress so that it can then actually be spent. And Congress has been reluctant to do that. And also, Congress wants to cut back the money that is put into the fund in the first place. So there's a bit of a battle going on there.
That was our Washington correspondent, Nancy Marshall, reporting from Capitol Hill. Coverage of the origins of life is made possible by NASA through support for the New York Center for Studies of the Origins of Life. It's located at the New York State University at Albany, the Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute, and the College of St. Rose. The Environment Show is a national production which is made possible by the W. Alton Jones Foundation, the William Bingham Foundation, the Turner Foundation, the J.M. Kaplan Fund, and Hemmings Motor News, the monthly Bible of the collector car hobby. www.hemmings.com. The Environment Show would like to hear your views, and sometimes we broadcast them. Give us a call at 1-888-49-GREEN. That's 1-888-49-GREEN. Email is green@wamc.org. That's green@wamc.org. Continuing our series on the search for the origins of life, I spoke with Dr. William Schupf. He's professor of paleobiology at the University of California, Los Angeles, and director of the Center for the Study of Evolution and the Origin of Life. Dr. Schupf is looking for evidence of life in ancient fossils, and he's the discoverer of some of the earliest known fossils, which are 3.5 billion years old. Much of our thinking about life on Earth has been influenced by Charles Darwin, the 19th century scientist who developed the modern theory of evolution. Darwin showed that the plants and animals around him evolved over time from simpler organisms. In examining fossils, which are over 3 billion years old, Dr. Schupf has found surprises which lead him to believe Darwin's evolutionary theory is flawed.
early life on this planet evolved by rules that are different from those of later life on this planet. And nobody expected that. You see, the rules of evolution we all know, and it's taught in every school around the world, is that evolution equals change. We know that there was the age of animals without backbones and seaweeds, and then there was the age of spore-producing plants and the age of reptiles, and then the age of warm-blooded mammals and flowering plants. And we think of the history of life as changing over time. That's what Darwin taught us, and that's what Darwin knew. But he didn't know anything about the earliest 85% of Earth history. He only knew about the last 15% of the history of life.
Schuff says characteristics of living things as we know them now were late in appearing.
What it turns out to be that for most of that earliest 85% of the history of life, things did not change. You can take an organism, a fossil organism, 2 billion years in age, and compare it to an organism living today, a microbe living today, and the microbes haven't changed. They live in the same place. They look the same. They're the same size. They divided the same way. They live in the same communities. They live in the same environments. The fact is that life on this planet, once it got started, it developed a really nice way to live, and then it just sat there.
Schuff says the earliest form of life that Darwin identified was an organism called a trilobite. It looks like a tiny lobster. Darwin knew that the trilobite was a complicated organism which had to be preceded by something more primitive. But since his fossil records only went back 500 million years, earlier life forms were beyond his reach. Research conducted by Schuff and his colleagues show the span of life on the planet is much greater than previously imagined.
The Earth is 4.5 billion years in age. Let's imagine that we took all of Earth history and condensed it down to a 24-hour day, so that the day begins at midnight last night, and there's one 24-hour day, which represents all of the history of this entire planet, everything that's ever happened. Well, in Darwin's time, in that 24-hour day, his oldest fossils, these trilobites, would have been deposited at 9 o'clock at night. So all of the geologic history that Darwin knew was from 9 o'clock at night until midnight.
Professor Schuff says humans and even mammals have been here for only a very short time.
What we know now is that the oldest fossils would have been entombed in these rocks in Western Australia at about 5:30 in the morning. And then life evolved very, very slowly from 5:30 in the morning through 9 o'clock to noon up until about 6 o'clock at night, when the first sexually reproducing organisms evolved. And from them, it developed multicellular, many-celled sorts of organisms, more complicated things. Seaweeds come in at about 8:30 at night, jellyfish at 8:45, then Darwin's trilobites at 9 o'clock, and dinosaurs wouldn't come in until about 11 o'clock at night. Mammals, the rise of mammals at about 11:40, and humans just a few seconds before midnight.
More than 100 years after Darwin lived, the discovery of fossils that are billions of years old gives us a much longer view of life on the planet.
In the last 30 years, the total history of life has been increased by sevenfold, which is enormous. We know about the early history of life things that were never known before. And it says that life evolved very fast, very early in Earth history. And I think it went very far, too, because some of these very primitive early organisms are actually rather advanced.
Schuff says we know both the Earth and the Moon were blasted by meteorites during a period which ended 3.8 billion years ago. The bombardment was so intense that big objects hitting the Earth could have vaporized the oceans and any life they may have contained. He says it is possible that during the first billion years of the Earth's existence, life may have begun and been extinguished a number of times. Schuff believes things started to flourish once the meteor shower was over.
Maybe life began 4 billion or 3.9 or 3.8 billion years ago, and here, already by 3.5 billion years ago, we've got a flourishing biota, all microscopic things, little pond scum, all over the surface of this Earth. This is a pond scummish Earth. And these guys living happily, just a thriving biota, and all that happened in a short period of time, and that's what we're trying to figure out.
That was Professor William Schuff, professor of paleobiology at the University of California, Los Angeles, discussing the origins of life on Earth. And now it's time for the Earth calendar. As we speak, crayfish are busy just trying to survive in Missouri. They can be found in rivers, streams, lakes, ponds, marshes, ditches, and even underground caves. Crayfish are an important part of the food chain, and Bob DeStefano, fisheries research biologist with the Missouri Department of Conservation, says various fish species are among the many animals feeding on crayfish during the summer months.
Then we have amphibians such as frogs and salamanders. And we even have a large member of the salamander family here in Missouri called a hellbender that eats almost nothing but crayfish. Reptiles such as snakes and turtles feed heavily on crayfishes. Birds such as herons and, believe it or not, even birds like wild turkeys and owls will feed on crayfish. And then, of course, mammals. Everyone's familiar with raccoons, and they feed heavily on crayfish. Mink, black bear feed on crayfish. And river otters, in fact, river otters in some areas of the country are about 60 or 70% of their diet is thought to be made up of crayfish.
DeStefano adds that larger insects will feed on younger crayfish. Crayfish are also predators. They eat such things as plants and decaying material, and they consume very small organisms, insects, snails, and even other crayfish. In short, crayfish feed on almost everything in the water, and almost everything feed on crayfish. However, crayfish face threats other than predation, such as habitat destruction, pollution, and in-stream gravel mining. Bob DeStefano says alien species are also adversely affecting some crayfish populations.
Crayfishes from other drainages or other areas of the country being released into our waters, these species can outcompete, flourish and outcompete native species, and we have about seven species here in Missouri that occur nowhere else in the world, and currently two of them are in trouble because a species has been brought in from another watershed, and it is literally pushing them out of the one watershed that they occur in.
Crayfish normally live between 2 to 7 years, depending on the species. DeStefano says they're crustaceans, which means they're related to lobsters, shrimps, and crabs.
They have a hard exoskeleton or shell, but they're also called decapods, which literally translated means they have 10 legs or 5 pairs of legs. And the front two legs, which is what a lot of people recognize crayfish by, the front two legs are modified into structures that scientists call chelae, but lay people refer to as pinchers or claws.
Bob DeStefano says there are more than 300 crayfish species, which come in many colors.
Many of the common species range from greenish to brownish to yellowish in color, but we have species here in Missouri that are bright blue. We have one species that actually is red, white, and blue. Some orange species exist. We've got one that's a golden yellow with black freckles on it. So there's just a diversity of colors.
Humans often use crayfish as bait while fishing. Many of us also enjoy eating crayfish. Few people realize that in cold climates, energy production can actually increase some crayfish populations. Reports say crayfish living in the warm water discharge of a nuclear power plant in Finland are reproducing at 3 times the normal rate. Crayfish are a Finnish delicacy in the summer, so if you're traveling to Finland at this time of year, bring your appetite and order crayfish. If they taste like a nuclear reactor and glow in the dark, you'll know there are plenty more. You're listening to The Environment Show, and I'm Peter Burley. This is The Environment Show, and I'm Peter Burley. Still ahead. The California sea otter population is declining. Scientists are not sure why, but a whole system of relationships between predator and prey could change, resulting in fewer fish in California waters. We talk green about increasing human population and the health of the planet. There are about to be 6 billion of us, a threefold increase in 70 years. And listeners comment on personal watercraft, organic food, plastic and paper bags, and the water shortage in the Middle East. Stay with us. Of all the marine mammals that live in coastal waters of the western United States, few are as cute and playful as the California sea otter. Besides being cute to look at, they play an important role in aquatic ecosystems because they keep other species in check and help ocean plants. But scientists tell us the number of California sea otters is declining, and they cannot say for certain why it is happening. As Caitlin Kim reports, the reduction of otters has significant environmental implications.
Many scientists believe that by 1999, the status of the California sea otter would have changed for the better. It was listed as a threatened species in the 1970s, and scientists had hoped by now the animal could be delisted. Unfortunately, that is not the case. Jim Estes with the U.S. Geological Survey explains.
Now we're looking at a situation where instead of having continued toward that delisting criterion or proposed delisting criterion, the number is actually on the wane and is headed and is now really very much closer to a number that we would consider to be appropriate for uplisting from threatened to endangered.
According to researchers, the overall decline of the California sea otter population this spring was 1.14%. Not very large, but within that population, a higher percentage of adult and subadult sea otters declined. David Jessup is senior wildlife veterinarian with the California Department of Fish and Game.
The reproductive segment of the population has dropped another 5% on top of a nearly 12% or 12-plus percent decline over the last 3 years. So the trend is clear. It continues to be down. It continues to be the reproductive segment of the population that's critical for any future recovery.
California sea otters have always grown at a slow rate, between 4 to 5%. The California population reached a high of 2,377 in 1995 and has declined ever since. What concerns researchers is they haven't seen declines like this before. Jim Estes.
We don't understand it in the sense that we don't know why the numbers are going down, for sure.
Are there some theories or speculations?
There are a variety of potential explanations, none of which I think is strongly embraced by any one person. They're just kind of a list of things that, for one reason or another, we're suspicious about, essentially three. But the first of those is just a food limitation, that the population has reduced its food supply and is in decline for that reason. Personally, I think that's the least likely, but it is certainly a possibility. The second is infectious disease, and the concern there is that a high proportion of the carcasses that we recover from the beaches over time have been diagnosed as having died from infectious disease, about 40% overall. We have no evidence that the incidence of infectious disease has increased over the last 5 or 10 years. So that would be perhaps some evidence that that's not the reason, but just the very high incidence of infectious diseases is enough to worry about itself, I think. And the third possibility is that there has been an increased loss rate to entanglement in fishing gear.
Estes says the California decline stands out because in most of the Northwest, other sea otter populations are going up, with the exception of the Aleutian Island sea otters, whose decline is being blamed on killer whales. Shellfish fishermen, whose livelihood could be threatened by the spreading otter population, which eats 15 to 20 pounds of shellfish a day, say there is no crisis. They believe the otter has simply reached carrying capacity along the coast as part of the natural process. But David Jessup of California Fish and Game disagrees. He doesn't think this is just a temporary downward trend.
When you have 5 or 6 points on a graph and they all lead in the same direction, and when that direction is down, and when you have an independent indicator of dead animals that is consistently going up, and when you see new and emerging diseases, that's a pretty good indication that you have a relatively serious and profound problem. This isn't just a statistical fluke, that the population decline is real, and the concerns for ecosystem health are quite real.
The California sea otters, with their grizzled faces and long whiskers, are an important part of the ecosystem. They are a keystone species and can change the ecological system in which they live. David Jessup.
In areas where sea otters are abundant, sea urchins and some other species that prey on the stipes or roots of the kelp forest are in very low numbers. And so the kelp forest comes back, and finfish species are present in larger abundance. Where sea otters are absent, sea urchins and other predators on kelp increase, and the kelp forest declines. So they actually have the ability to structure, to some degree, the environment in which they live.
The sea otter is also a good bioindicator species that accumulates toxins and contaminants. The population's drop could indicate that the health of the California ecosystem is in decline. David Jessup.
And that's one of the things that we're trying to emphasize, that it's not just a species interest, that this has implications for the health of California's nearshore ecosystems.
Jim Estes with USGS thinks the decline of the California sea otter has global implications.
I think that the issue of the decline is, you know, put in a larger context, is really of great concern because of all of the growing evidence from the oceans worldwide of declines and ecological problems, management problems, pollution, overfishing. You know, we don't understand why, but we do know that more and more people are living close to the sea, and that our effluents all enter the sea into the coastal zone. And, you know, in that broader context, I think that this is probably a signal that should be worrying us.
At the moment, very little is being done about the situation. In the early 90s, when the California sea otter population was growing, the strategy chosen was to let the recovery and growth happen naturally, and funding was redirected to other projects. For the Environment Show, I'm Caitlin Kim.
We are Talking Green, and I'm Peter Burley. Today we're going to be talking about what many say is the world's foremost environmental challenge, and that is how we achieve global sustainability in an era of exploding population growth. World population, just about 6 billion, is almost a threefold increase from the numbers when I was born, and there are projections that say it could double again in the next 50 years. My guests are two people who have spent their entire careers working on population issues, and we're going to discuss efforts to limit population growth, what works, what doesn't work, what the public policy options are, and basically where we and our reproductive capacity is going to take the globe. With me is Pat Walk, and she is senior advisor to the National Audubon Society and for population issues. And I should say that she worked for me very effectively when I was president of NAS. Also with us is Dan Pellegrim, and he is president of Pathfinder International. That's a nonprofit organization that works with institutions all over the world to create and improve access to information about reproductive health services. Pat, I'd like to start with you. For people who haven't thought about this much before, why are environmentalists even worried about increasing population? I recall that Julian Simon, with whom you used to disagree violently all the time, said population growth is a great thing. It means more people with more ideas to give us more productivity.
Well, I think that most people currently can see the changes that are going on around them, even in the United States. And so they have a much clearer view of what's happening to the natural environment as more and more people inhabit the Earth and just try to meet their own needs for fuel, wood, or water, clean water, things like that. It's clear that we are experiencing an unprecedented experience for this planet. We have more people than we've ever had in the history, and each of those people have aspirations for what they want their life to be like and how they want to live. Even in the United States, you can hear people talk about forests where they used to wander or streams they used to fish in. That have either been paved over, drained, cut down, and disappeared. And so if we are to live in a natural world with all of its benefits, both physical and emotional and spiritual, we have to be concerned about the number of people and how they're living with those natural resources.
Well, Dan Pellegrim from Pathfinder, we see also, though, that places like Western Europe, highly developed nations, have very low fertility rates. Is this indeed then a third world problem?
I think it's a problem for all of us. I think the globe, again, we talk about the globe getting closer and closer, being drawn tighter and tighter to each other around the world. We don't always live like it. I think that the issues that we face as citizens of this globe will increasingly impact each other. Yes, indeed. The problem, we should not be, I think, careless in minimizing the concerns of people in countries where fertility rates are low, like in Europe. Those bring issues for those people that we need to take seriously. But in fact, we began the century with 2 billion human inhabitants, and we will enter the next century with 6 billion human inhabitants. In the last 40 years, since 1960, the globe's population has doubled, and the growth that's projected in the future for the globe is 95% of the globe's future growth is projected to occur in the least developed countries. So you could say, in one sense, that the future projections would slant it towards a concern for the poorest of the poor countries. And there are lots of things to talk about in that, ways in which the first world can help the less developed countries manage and deal with these problems. And indeed, there are very significant lessons that can be learned there. But I do believe it's a problem for all of us. If the biggest environmental problem in a Western industrialized country like ours is consumption and pollution, then the biggest environmental problem in a poverty-stricken country probably is its growth in population numbers.
Pat, you and I were at the population conference that the UN sponsored in Cairo a number of years ago. And I thought one of the interesting things about that conference is that the whole issue of birth control was regarded as just a small segment of the problem. What are some of the other pieces of this that have to be dealt with if indeed we're going to stabilize population growth?
Well, I don't think we should minimize the access to birth control, because we can do all the other things that I'm getting ready to talk about and not have access to modern means of contraception, and we'll be in deep trouble. But we do know, and we've known for a number of years now, that the more education women have, that there's a direct correlation with both reduced fertility rates and higher rates of children's survival. And infant mortality rates reduced also give mothers greater confidence that their children will survive. So education and decrease in infant mortality are important factors. Women's status is improved, and that becomes a factor in decline in fertility rates. For example, if they have the right to inherit land, and also having an option for employment that allows them to define their roles in society other than being a mother, or in addition to being a mother if they so choose. Those five factors we've seen over the years have been very, very important in improved quality of life and greater personal control over one's life. And I think what happened at Cairo was that there was a strong impetus towards recognizing all of these factors as being absolutely essential to bringing fertility rates down, and more importantly, to giving women the right to have a healthy life.
Dan, my understanding is that your organization is in the business of promoting birth control worldwide. Where are some of the programs working, and where are they not working, and why?
Well, there are great success stories out there. Indeed, contraceptive prevalence rates worldwide have expanded dramatically in the last 20 years. Fertility has fallen from 6 to 3.3 since the 1950s. Contraceptive prevalence worldwide now stands at 58% and climbing. Which is really a dramatic silent revolution, in fact, women taking control of their own lives by spacing their children. All of the things that my colleague Pat Walk just said are true, that it's not just a matter of making family planning services available. It is acknowledging the importance of women in broader kinds of ways, making them participate in helping them participate in the economy, acknowledging their important role in the society is critical. You asked me for successes as well as failures. There are countries that are more successful than others. That's to be sure. Mexico's birth rate has fallen from 7 children per couple in 1965 to 2.5 today, a dramatic change that most Americans are unaware of. Brazil has dropped to a birth rate of 2.3. Remarkable success again in Colombia is at 2.7, a remarkable decline in the last 20 years in Colombia. In Bangladesh, one of the poorest countries in the world, we've gone from a situation where in the 1970s the average number of children per woman was 7, now dropping to 3 in the late 1990s. And in Kenya, which was only a few years ago, half a dozen or 8 years ago, that had the highest birth rate in the world with over 8 children born per couple, we now have seen a decline to 4.5, which is, again, an astounding decrease, one of the fastest decreases ever measured.
Now,
so even in sub-Saharan Africa, we're getting major changes in some countries that are hopeful. But we've got a lot of work to do in the Indian subcontinent.
Have these decreases occurred as a result of specific public policy options brought about by governments or by private sector or what?
It's interesting because it varies some. Colombia, for instance, does not reflect a change in much public policy. There's not much public policy shift in Colombia. It's primarily private sector that has led the way in Colombia. But in Mexico, it's certainly been a very keen effort by public sector. In Kenya as well, a considerable effort by public sector. In Bangladesh, a major effort by public sector. So it will vary from country to country, and interventions need to accommodate culture and politics. And public policy is, of course, a critical matter in many of these countries, but it's not always the lead factor.
Pat, my recollection is that in an earlier stage of your career, you were engaged in some of this kind of clinical activity on the ground in Brazil.
That's right.
How do people react to someone from a different culture with perhaps different values at the village level coming and telling them about birth control?
Well, you know, I'd like to answer that in a couple of ways, and it's true. Brazil was my first big experience as a Peace Corps volunteer nurse in northeastern Brazil, and the days, by the way, when you couldn't talk about birth control or family planning at all. And I think, you know, listening to Dan talk about Brazil and having been back there recently and also looking at some of the data, there's a very good piece that's come out about Brazil. It was really the private sector that made some of the major changes in Brazil, and it was the state policies that started the real shift. But to answer your question, I think that a lot of us in the 60s who went into the Peace Corps thought we were going to save the world, and probably still do. We wouldn't continue in this.
And indeed you did. It's just the world just fell apart again.
But I think that what's interesting is that in my early experience, it was learning to, in essence, help people do what they already knew in their infinite wisdom needed to be done. In other words, you didn't have to tell a woman who'd had 21 pregnancies by the time she was 35 that that wasn't good for her health. She knew it. She just didn't know how to get out of it. And so it was listening to the people and working with them to help them design programs that really met their needs. And I must say that years later, working with in government and with the university and other programs, that I, and Dan can respond to this, but I have found that the programs that seemed to be the most successful were not where we went in and imposed certain values and ideas, but where we went in and listened to people and got them involved in the design of the programs, the determination of the goals, and really involved in people in delivering services.
Dan, if there is more money available for various countries, does this make a big difference, or is it something else?
That's a big piece of it. There is no question but that more services need to be available to more people in more places, and in many of the countries where birth rates remain high, there's just not enough services. And I don't mean just family planning services, but reproductive health care services more broadly. There have been some pretty reliable demographic studies that indicate that 50% of the population growth that is projected would not occur if we simply made the services available. That is to say, we wouldn't need to change public policies or wrestle with culture and religious objections. If we could just make the services available, we could get 50% of the as it was put earlier. We could save 50% of the world. That is to say, we could get halfway there.
My guests have been Pat Walk from the National Audubon Society and Dan Pellegram from Pathfinder International. We've been discussing population, family planning, and how one stabilizes population growth. I'm sure you have views about this, so give us a call. Our number is 1-888-49-GREEN. We've been talking green, and I'm Peter Burley. You can listen to The Environment Show anytime on your personal computer. Go to our website, www.enn.com/envshow. That's www.enn.com/envshow. You can also tell us what you think while you're online. Time now to hear what some of our listeners are saying. Here's Susan Arbetter.
A recent Talking Green on jet skis, also known as personal watercraft, inspired some listeners to call our comment line.
Thank you for offering the public to give comments, because I get so frustrated and I need this kind of outlet. And I have experienced a lot of frustration just because they're so disruptive to quiet, peaceful, relaxing time at the beach. That plus the fact that they're so polluting. I mean, personally, I think they should be very restricted. And the minimum that I think should be done is that there should be lakes that should have an outlaw against the personalized watercraft.
Another listener to the discussion about jet skis called to say that there are essentially two types of people, those who care about the environment and how their actions affect it and other people, and those who do not. He says legislation is necessary to protect the environment and others from people who don't care. On another recent Talking Green, we discussed organic agriculture, an industry this listener supports.
Physically, my body feels much better when I eat something that's organic than something that's grown with chemicals. Mother has rheumatoid arthritis. Maybe I'm more sensitive to it. Who knows? But I truly believe that is the best way to live one's life. Helps a lot of people. And you know what? I think a lot of health problems would be lessened by it. I was also into nursing. I'm studying herbology and other organic growing techniques on my own. And I truly believe that is the way of the future.
A listener by the name of Jeff emailed us regarding a green tip that addressed whether it's better to use paper or plastic bags when carrying goods home from the grocery store. The Union of Concerned Scientists says both types of bags have an equal impact on the environment, and that focusing on the bigger issues, such as buying a more efficient refrigerator, can have a larger effect on the environment as a whole. But Jeff says, quote, you shouldn't discourage people from making the little choices. One only buys a refrigerator very rarely. There's a good choice in the paper versus plastic debate, and that is neither. The environmental choice is to bring your own bags, reuse bags, and use canvas bags, end quote. Some weeks back, we aired a discussion on the fresh water crisis in the Middle East that featured former Illinois Senator Paul Simon. This listener says an important issue was not addressed.
I noticed that none of the people discussing the topic referred to the use of composting toilets as a way of mitigating the developing water shortage. Composting toilets, of course, use no water at all and very little energy, very little outside energy anyway. If they require blowers, they can be operated with using solar power. Composting toilets have been in use for at least a century in much of Scandinavia, and perhaps over the last 50 years in Western Europe, and in part in the United States over the last 20 years.
We appreciate all comments, questions, and suggestions. You can reach our comment line by dialing 1-888-49-GREEN. That's 1-888-49-GREEN. For The Environment Show, I'm Susan Arbetter.
Hello, operator, I want you to be mine. Please deposit all your love and put me on the line. I'm listed under lonely, lost and feeling small. Dial directly to my heart and bill me for the call.
Thanks for being with us in this week's Environment Show. I'm Peter Burley. Life began 3 billion years earlier than Darwin thought, and global human population has tripled within this century. We celebrate the diversity of it all with Governor Jesse Ventura, crayfish, and sea otters. Order a copy of the program by calling 1-800-323-9262 and ask for show number 501. The Environment Show is a national production which is solely responsible for its content. Alan Chartok is executive producer, Stephen Westcott is producer, and the show is made possible by the W. Alton Jones Foundation, the William Bingham Foundation, the Turner Foundation, the J.M. Kaplan Fund, and Hemmings Motor News, the monthly Bible of the collector car hobby. www.hemmings.com. Be good to the Earth and join us next week for the Environment Show.